Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Good morning, y'all. Y'all can be seated. Thank you very much. Good morning. Well, welcome to the Third Court of Appeals, the entire Third Court of Appeals. We're glad to have you all here. This is cause number 032058CV, Bertucci et al. Versus Watkins et al. And the entire court does welcome you, and we recognize that this is a unique experience for most of us. I was conferring with Mr. Kyle earlier this morning. In 17 years, there's never been en banc oral argument. And I think there's only been about two or three en bancs by submission since that time. So this is certainly a unique and interesting case and dispute. We look forward to working with you and hearing from you about that today. This matter, as you may know, is also being simultaneously broadcast via YouTube. Later on this afternoon, the audio of this proceeding will be available to you on our website, and our YouTube feed will also continuously be available to you and the public as well. I'd like to remind you of the timing mechanism that we have here. I understand that the appellants are going to take 15 minutes for their opening, then the appellees will take 30, and then the appellants will take 15 in their rebuttal. The yellow light in our time notification system will let you know that you have 2 minutes left. The red light means that your time is up. The court, at its discretion, may obviously provide you with additional time, but please try to be mindful of that. We are giving each side a little bit more time today than is normal under our protocols. But that's in light of the significance of the matters at stake here today. I'd ask that the attorneys introduce themselves to the court and announce ready.
Yes, Your Honor, Steve Fleckman and Andrew McCann, and we are ready on behalf of the appellants.
Thank you.
Good morning. Heidi Block with Greenberg Traurig on behalf of the appellee Eugene Watkins, and with me at counsel table is Timothy Zyer.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And with that said, we call the case, and Mr. Fleckman. Certainly.
Your Honor, I have we have provided a handout this morning, and I hope that it's available. I am going to begin by addressing jurisdiction. I know that we have been quite accustomed to the idea that interlocutory orders are not final, but we have Supreme Court precedents. The issue of concern to the court panel had been that there had been a severance of an attorney's fee claim in the case, and that was part of the Theft Liability Act claim that had been resolved on summary judgment as part of the final judgment. The parties share a common view that their stipulation resolved the severed attorney's fee issue and has eliminated any impediment to the exercise of appellate jurisdiction here.
May I jump in on that very question? As I view the stipulation, it doesn't discuss Bertucci's status and his derivative role on behalf of the companies. Does this resolve all attorney's fees issues?
It does.
What if he's in both his derivative and his individual capacity?
Yes, Justice Goodwin, it's a global agreement that the only attorney's fees that will be awarded are identical for each side, and no further application for attorney's fees will be made nor adjudicated. I will briefly address the Supreme Court precedents because they may be of concern to this court. The Supreme Court precedents of Pierce, Schieffer, Lehman, Elizondo, and Bella Palma, the
Mr.
latter
Fleckman,
two.
May I ask one thing before you do that, and I really appreciate that you're going to make that clear. But could you also, in addressing those issues, address the issue of, does it make a difference that it's a jury trial versus a summary judgment? I noticed some differences in the precedent related to that. And does it make a difference at all that this is arising from a probate proceeding? In addition, as you're going through this?
The court has, yes, the Supreme Court has been very clear that the rules that I'm going to speak to today apply only in non-jury trial settings. As to the other issue, which is the probate court, this court has recognized in the past that probate courts are unique in that they have phased resolutions of various issues, and that can result in the generation of final judgments that still leave for resolution other matters pending before the probate court. These precedents, two of which were decided after DeLisa, that's Elizondo and Bella Palma, collectively teach that unmistakably clear finality language, such as we have in the present judgment pending before you, renders that judgment appealable, precluding record review. Even if the severance may erroneously split a single cause of action. That's not intuitive, but those are the precedents. We look, therefore, to a decision issued by the Supreme Court 3 weeks ago, the Michie decision, which teaches us something about their view of stare decisis. And the court has made it clear that they regard stare decisis as so essential to the stability of our legal system that the court does not intend to casually abandon its precedents. In fact, it carefully analyzed the pros and cons of the Philbrook decision before overruling it in great detail, even though the court acknowledged that it regarded the precedent as wrongly decided. The key distinction in the Morello case is that the severance there was considered proper. So the court did not engage in the detailed and painstaking examination of precedent. For that reason, in view of Michie, it may be imprudent to infer that there was a determination to overrule the earlier precedents and recent precedents of Elizondo, Bella Palma, Schaefer, and Lehman. With that, unless there are questions on jurisdiction, I will turn to the merits today.
Well, let me just ask you, Mr. Fleckman, just to talk about Morello. So if you don't think that they are implicitly overruling Pierce and the progeny, then what does that mean? What did the Texas Supreme Court mean when it said clearly jurisdiction can be brought up an appellate, whether, it was brought up in the trial court?
There is unquestionably an implication in that sentence that recognition that jurisdictional challenges can be brought up at the appellate level, no question about it. Whether the court was actually giving the sort of intense scrutiny to its previous precedents that one would expect in light of Michie, that I can't answer. But Michie does seem to represent an attitude that the court will endeavor to engage in a very detailed consideration of pros and cons before it overrules its precedents, simply because of its view that stability and predictability are essential to the function of the judicial system and to the signals that it gives to the public of neutrality.
And that raises a question on Morello, because Morello mentions DeLisa, but it doesn't negatively mention DeLisa. So, the precedent that we have in this court is DeLisa.
You do indeed. And DeLisa, clearly, as I read it, it impresses one as well thought out. There were opposing mirror image claims. So I can't necessarily tell you that I can square it with Elizondo, but it appears that the Supreme Court has decided over the years that two things, essentially. One is that the jurisdictional issue should be determined on the face of the judgment, and that record review is precluded if the language of the judgment is unmistakably clear as to finality.
So you're in agreement with the dissent in this case?
I'm sorry, Judge Adriana.
You're in agreement with the dissent in this case?
I am in agreement with the dissent, but I read the majority memorandum opinion carefully, and I thought it raised good points in all candor. The reason I'm in agreement is because the court had no occasion to examine anything other than recognizing the propriety of the severance was dicta at that point. And the second thing is that one can attribute different meanings to the terms "that being so." It could either mean, since it is an appropriate severance, we proceed to our decision on the merits of this case, rather than considering something else. Or it could mean, because it was an appropriate severance, we have jurisdiction, and that's a question of interpretation.
If an appellate court has the jurisdiction to determine whether it has jurisdiction, I think we've all decided that's, yes, we get to do that, right?
Right.
Is this where you're talking about whether or not we should be overruling DeLisa or not? Am I on the same page as you?
Well, I think that Michki brought up something very important. They thanked the appellate court for signaling the issue for their consideration, but they followed the precedent of the Supreme Court. So in this situation, I would think that overruling DeLisa would be the appropriate thing to do, even if the court on bank decides to flag the issue as extremely important to reconsider at the Supreme Court level.
And you think that it's this, so we don't need the stipulation in order to reconsider DeLisa, or does the stipulation assist us in reconsidering DeLisa?
Well, the stipulation creates a bit of an issue here.
Right.
That doesn't prevent the court from flagging the issue, however. But the stipulation does, in my view, moot the issue in terms of any obstruction to your exercise of appellate jurisdiction, because it removes the one issue that clouded the question of jurisdiction.
So then the reason for, in theory, the reason for this en banc, this monumental day, is moot.
It could be perceived as moot, but it may be helpful still to flag the issue.
Let me ask you about the stipulation, because even in y'all's joint motion, where you talk about the stipulation, and assuming that the derivative and the individual capacities, those things are all resolved too, in y'all's joint motion, you suggest the stipulation removes any possible jurisdictional impediment that may have existed. And then you cite a bunch of cases, and then you talk about in your parentheticals what the appropriate remedy is in that instance, and it's abatement. Isn't abatement to the trial court for resolution of what remains, isn't that necessarily instructive on whether or not this is a jurisdictional impediment or not?
Justice Goodwin, the cases from the Supreme Court say that two things. One is, those cases seem to say that even if there is appellate jurisdiction, the Court of Appeals still retains its ability to set aside an erroneous severance. So that is an avenue that's available to the Court of Appeals. The question, I suppose, is what happens then? And what we've tried to do, we've been litigating this case for 6 years, and my client died during those 6 years. Both sides are hopeful and desirous for a resolution. So we have tried to eliminate any impediment to your consideration of the merits.
Understood.
It's not like the district court cannot adjudicate the attorney's fee issue in a different case if this arose. Here, they don't need to, however. Turning to the merits of the case, just to provide brief context, when my client, Mr. Bertuzzi, died in 2017 during this litigation, he had spent 15 years in a co-venture with his good friend, Mr. Watkins, to develop low-income housing here in Texas and in Nashville, Tennessee. Mr. Bertuzzi provided all of the funding.
Mr. Blackman, in your argument on the merits, I have a question. There's a lot said about the audit report. In reading your briefing, it appears to me we're raising that there are fact issues everywhere. On every cause of action, there are fact issues, and so it was error to grant a motion for summary judgment. Get rid of the audit report. Are there still fact issues, and does it need to go back down to Judge Herman's court for a trial?
Very interesting question, and I think the answer to that is it should go back down in that event, and let me say why.
Either way, with the audit report or without it, or in both instances?
Well, I think it needs to go down in both instances. First of all, the audit report has two aspects to it. The one is that it purports to be a Rule 172 audit report, but in our view, it does not have the elements necessary to qualify it. It nonetheless could become a material expert report. We challenge its compliance with the principles that the Supreme Court and other courts have laid out for expert reports, but that doesn't mean that our opponents don't get an opportunity to present that evidence. So even if it is regarded as not being an audit report, it sheds light on a key issue here. There are defenses of limitations that have been challenged, and credibility is enormously important here because I have a decedent as a client, and he cannot speak and he cannot contradict many of these statements that are made about his understandings and agreements along the way over this 14-year period. So if this went down, in other words, I'm not sure, in candor, I'm not sure that the Rules 172 audit report is the end of the hunt for my adversaries. I think that they still have a right to a trial, and we have a right to a trial on credibility issues and on numerous fact issues. I probably won't be able to get into all of those fact issues, but they're laid out in our briefing.
So Mr. Blackman, are you saying that what your client is advocating is for us to reverse the summary judgment and remand for a trial on all issues?
The rule is that with cross motions for summary judgment, the court can do exactly what it needs to do and render the judgment that should have been rendered below.
Even if one of the parties doesn't ask for final relief?
Even if one of the parties has not asked, that's what the Court of Appeals has the ability to do. Our position is that we have filed a summary judgment motion saying there is no accounting. If you strike the audit report, then there is no accounting. We have said in our motion for summary judgment that Mr. Watkins occupied a fiduciary position for any of various reasons, including the fact that he was the custodian and control person of the monies. And he elected, whether he was assigned it or not, or it was just delegated to him by agreement, he elected to do the accounting for this business. And so if he elected to do the accounting for this business, then did he provide appropriate accounting?
So what could be missing from the unverified report or shown from the low-income housing credits that you didn't already have through those public filings? And what does that do to the discovery rule? And Barry?
I'll get right into that. There's a lot of background that would be helpful, but I'm going to just synthesize it. The key things that I think would be helpful to know about this case are, number one, Mr. Watkins contends that he did provide accounting through the years to Mr. Bertuzzi. So taking that on its face, the question is was it accurate accounting such that Mr. Bertuzzi could have, number one, understood that there were misappropriations from the account, or at least been on notice of that. The only two spreadsheets we have from Mr. Watkins that he identifies in his summary judgment record as being contemporaneous are 8 years, cover 8 years of the venture. And he claims he showed those to Mr. Bertuzzi. So answering your question, if you look at those spreadsheets, as we have discussed in our briefing, you will find that they conflict with the 2018, what I call litigation spreadsheets, that Mr. Watkins developed once he was in litigation. And they conflict in material ways, which raises a key fact issue, not only as to the contradiction between the spreadsheets, but also as to the credibility of the witness against Mr. Bertuzzi.
Mr. Fleckman and Justices, if you don't mind, I'm going to put a pin in that because you have another question.
I don't think I got my question answered. It's a maybe basic for me, but obviously not a clear answer. What is it that you're asking this court? Are you asking us to look at the competing summary judgment motions and rule and render? Or are you saying it needs to go back? And if it needs to go back, for what reason, for what to try?
I'm going to give alternative answers. If you conclude in looking at our motion that there is no accounting and that Mr. Watkins occupied a fiduciary position by reason of his control of the funds, then I think you are enabled by this record to reach a final decision in favor of the Bertuzzi family and the Bertuzzi estate. If you find facts, including whether they are simply based on the presumptions that the summary judgment rules impose, or because of credibility, if you find fact issues, then a remand is warranted.
And Judge, does that satisfy you on this point? I just want to make sure that we give Ms. Block her adequate time.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fleckman. We'll get back to you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Block.
May it please the court. Good morning, and Chief, I'm glad you recognize the significance of this en banc. I know I speak for both of us when I say what a privilege it is to be appearing on behalf of all of you. You usually travel in threes, so this is quite a privilege. So this seemingly very complicated case is really quite simple. It really boils down to a suspicious son who is now second-guessing just about every business decision that his father made while his father was in business with my client, Mr. Watkins, over the course of almost a 15-year period that began almost 20 years ago. Now, the two gentlemen, Mr. Watkins and Mr. Bertuzzi, and when I refer to Mr. Bertuzzi, I'm speaking about the decedent, Anthony Bertuzzi, they worked well together for almost 15 years. They met regularly to discuss the finances. Mr. Bertuzzi funded the companies. Mr. Watkins put in the sweat equity, but they both knew exactly what was going on with the companies. And now we have Mr. Bertuzzi's son, though, after his father passed away, who is suspicious about where some of the funds were spent, and it was demanding that my client reaccount for every dollar that was spent for various different projects, for various different companies, over that entire 15-year period. And without any evidence of any actual misappropriation, He's insisting on an accounting. It's actually a reaccounting because my client, the summary judgment evidence demonstrates, did account to Mr. Bertucci as time went on, when the transactions occurred. And this seemingly mess of a case is exactly why we have and have to enforce the statutes of limitations. When time passes, memories fade, records get destroyed. In the ordinary course, they get destroyed. Records get lost. People die. We have all three of those things occurring in this case. So in my short time with you today, I certainly want to answer any questions the court may have about any aspect of the case, but I intend to focus on three things. One, very briefly on the jurisdiction. I just have a couple more things to add on that. And two, the significance, if any, of the audit report. And three, why the statute of limitations is a complete bar to all of the executor's claims. And if you rule on that last issue on the statute of limitations, there is no need to address any other issue in the case. And the question, if the audit goes away, is there any fact issue left? No, because the statute of limitations bars all the claims.
And Ms. Block.
Yes.
I know that the parties prior to us taking up the issue on Bonk, as I'm sure it's not lost on you all, if we get to merits, this merits case in this court would typically be done on submission to the panel. It's a summary judgment case. That's how it would be handled. This would not be an en banc consideration on merits. Now, the significance of en banc is you had a panel that lined up with our prior precedent of DeLisa on jurisdiction. And that's the reason why we're all here. And the parties tendered an interesting proposal that I was trying to determine, is there any support for this under the law, which is, why don't we go in front of the entire court on the issue of jurisdiction related to DeLisa and then refer the merits back to a panel? That was at least proposed in some of the materials that were tendered. What's the support for that type of process?
Well, I think it's up to this court whether it wants to decide the merits en banc or if it wants to send it back to the panel. I think that's this court's decision. We are sitting here en banc primarily to address the jurisdictional issue. And, you know, I certainly agree that the stipulation about the attorney's fees, which was the only issue that was improperly severed, mooted the jurisdictional impediment, but this court sitting en banc, I submit to you, should take the opportunity to look at DeLisa, consider whether or not it should be overruled, and if the court en banc decides that it should take this opportunity to do that. And that would bring this court's precedent in line with other courts that have addressed the issue and in line with more recent Supreme Court precedent. And Mr. Fleckman mentioned some. I think he mentioned the Elizondo case. I think that's the key case. The Supreme Court has instructed you only look to the clear and unequivocal language of the final judgment. And if it's clear and unequivocal, you do not look to the merits. So you don't look to the merits first, decide that there's a jurisdictional impediment, and then dismiss the rest of the case. You just look to the final judgment. This one was clear and unequivocally final. It gave the court jurisdiction over the entire case, all of the merits. And again, if the court wants to send the merits back to the panel, that's up to this court. The letter of instruction to counsel asked us to address both. So we're here to address both.
And can I get in here on this point? Because if I represent to you that Rule 49 on the en banc reconsideration says, if a majority orders reconsideration, the judgment or order does not become final, and the case will be resubmitted to the court for an en banc review and disposition.
Okay.
And so that additional language, does that suggest, does it go back to the panel? Does it stay with the en banc
that
court?
That sounds like you, all six of you, are entangled in the merits. So, let me address those. I will note two things in the Michke case, which was this part of the supplemental authority we submitted earlier. This is back on jurisdiction. The Supreme Court says, and I quote, "We have repeatedly reversed courts of appeals for deploying unduly technical readings of the rules to block merits consideration." And then in a footnote, the court says, "All courts, regardless of the procedure used, should still make clear when they are repudiating their own case law." So the Supreme Court is suggesting this is a great opportunity to do that.
And Kelsey, before you get into the merits, when you're going through the three things you're going to talk about, you did mention the waiver of the derivative claims. Are you going to address that, the derivative claims?
I don't intend to. I don't have much time. There's so many issues, and we intend to rely on our brief on those. But if you have questions about it,
I just one basic question. I mean, were you prejudiced or misled by the omission?
We were surprised. I think it comes down to a briefing waiver issue. I understand courts are lenient on that, but there, I think the word derivative capacity only appears once in their brief, and the entire brief doesn't distinguish between the claims, and certainly doesn't distinguish between the entities. But there are certain legal principles that apply, for example, to the claims brought in an individual capacity by the executor on behalf of the estate, on the one hand, and the derivative claims that are brought in his capacity in a derivative capacity on behalf of the companies. And their brief just mixes and matches and lumps them all together. So to that extent, I think that's one of the things that makes this case more complicated, is that we don't really have a clear delineation from the appellant. What legal principles do they believe apply to which parties that would give them the relief that they're asking
for? Same question then on the stipulation, because the stipulation I didn't think addressed both issues. I don't think that the stipulation that
I agree with Mr. Fleckman that the parties intended, and we I think are both representing to the court that it did intend to address both individual capacity and derivative capacity.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Block, if I could shift to statute of limitations.
You bet.
We reviewed that just a moment ago. So in the traditional summary judgment, based on statute of limitations, failure to raise the fact issue under the discovery rule. So you argue that the discovery rule cannot protect the estate because Mr. Anthony Bertucci should have exercised due diligence by inquiring into TCB's account balance or activity. And in your brief, you cite a support via net, which involved parties to an insurance contract. But isn't this relationship here different? Isn't the relationship here different than the contract only relationship in that case, since they were co-owners in BW and not simply contracting parties, right?
Yes.
Do you have a better case to support your argument? Well,
the Barry versus Barry case is a good one. Again, recent Supreme Court authority. In that case, one of the plaintiffs, I think Mr. Barry, he was both a beneficiary of a trust and a co-trustee. So he was both owed duties and he owed duties to the trust. And the court talks about what are the responsibilities of the party to make reasonable inquiry and to be diligent in discovering if there is any wrongdoing. And the fact that Mr. Barry was a beneficiary did not absolve him from his responsibilities as a co-trustee to be aware of what was going on with the trust. So I submit to you that that's a case that more closely speaks to our situation. And we acknowledge that there were fiduciary duties owed by both parties to the entities. Mr. Fleckman mentioned a venture. There was no co-venture. There was no joint venture in the legal sense. The parties were very, very careful about setting up corporations, LLCs, limited partnerships. It is very clear that they did not have a joint venture in their individual capacities. So there were duties that were owed to the companies, but both of them owed those duties.
Also on the statute of limitations, on the failure to defeat limitations under CPRC 16069, mm-hmm. who bore what burden under that statute? Did Bertucci need only raise a fact issue under it?
Who bore the burden? Okay, let me think through this. Certainly, we're the movant under traditional motion for summary judgment. So we bore the burden of establishing that statute of limitations barred the claims. They claim 16069 revived them and saved them. And I'll submit to you, there aren't any real fact issues that go to that. It's really a legal determination as to whether or not that statute saves the claims. And let me just jump right to that. In order to be revived under section 16069, two things. The counter plaintiff that is attempting to revive the counterclaim must already be a party to the action. And that's in the statute, and I'm sorry I didn't include this in the handouts, but section 16069 says if a counterclaim or cross-claim arises out of the same transaction, not a similar one or a series of transactions, but the same transaction that is the basis of an action, a party to the action may file a counterclaim or cross-claim. So the party seeking to get a counterclaim revived has to already be a party to the action, and the only parties of the entities, the only parties that were already parties to that interpleader action were AAH, sorry about the alphabet soup, and AAHP, not the two Town Vista entities and not the Mid-Crown entity. Mr. Bertucci was also a party to that. So that knocks out three of the five entities. They, as a matter of law, they can't take advantage of 16069. But then the other part of that has to arise out of the same transaction or occurrence. And these clearly didn't. The interpleader action began in after the sale of four properties by, some of them were owned by AAH, some of them were owned by AAHP. Again, Town Vista, Mid-Crown, not involved in that whatsoever. These were raw, undeveloped lands. They never did develop these properties into the low-income housing. They bought the properties hoping to do that, but then they decided not to do that. So they sold the properties at a significant profit. So the only question in the interpleader is who gets the proceeds from those sales in 2015, I believe, the sales occurred. Who gets the proceeds from the sales of those properties? Those are the only questions. And that has nothing whatsoever to do with whether Mr. Watkins misappropriated any of the company's money or Mr. Bertucci's money for a period from 2001 up through 2009. Has nothing whatsoever to do with it. Now, the reason it was interpled is because Christopher Bertucci, the executor, refused to allow my client's funds that he was entitled to out of the sale of those four undeveloped properties. Christopher Bertucci refused to allow my client to get his proceeds. He was holding them ransom, really. And the Pelletier case that I submitted to you as supplemental authority, I think that speaks to the requirement that it be not a similar transaction, not even the same parties. Has to be the same transaction or occurrence. And in fact, the Pelletier case mentions another case that I think came out right around the time our brief was filed, and I apologize for not including this as well, but the Pelletier case mentions a TNC Construction versus Brown Mechanical Services case. It's a memorandum opinion. And that case, I think, is even closer to ours. You have the same parties working on projects over a period of time. One of the parties believed that in project number one, the other side was overpaid. So along comes project number two years later, and the party that thinks the other one was overpaid withholds some of the funds, saying, well, I overpaid you in project one, so I'm not going to pay you all I owe you on project two. So the other side sued on project two, saying, pay me the money you owe me. The first party said, okay, in that case, I'm going to counterclaim for the money that I overpaid you in project one. The court said, no, different projects. Even though it's the same parties, the same kind of construction projects that you were working on, different transactions, not the same. You cannot take advantage of 1609. And then while we're on the statute of limitations, excuse me, I want to talk about the discovery rule, because there are three. I think it's clear that statute of limitations would bar these claims that all arose in the mostly in the early to mid 2000s. Statute of limitations would bar the claims but for one of the savers. 1609 we've already talked about. The other two are discovery rule and fraudulent concealment. So let me speak to those for a minute. First of all, on the discovery rule, as a matter of law, it does not even apply. The Supreme Court has been very clear. It's a categorical analysis. It's not a case-by-case application. It only applies to cases where the injury is inherently undiscoverable and objectively verifiable. But this is not inherently undiscoverable. This is not the category of case. It's not, you know, a medical sponge left in a body or a latent construction defect. This is the money that Mr. Bertucci is investing in these companies being spent properly? There's nothing inherently undiscoverable about that. He was a director and officer of the companies. He was entitled to inspect the books and records at any time. The summary judgment evidence reveals that he did know exactly what was going on.
Now, is that intertwined with us also believing that the parties owed no fiduciary duties to each other?
Individually, they owed no fiduciary
duties.
That's
what I mean, individually. Yep. And so if we agree with you that they owe no fiduciary duties individually to each other, it doesn't matter that he was the accountant on these projects and Mr. Bertucci was the money man, but they still owed no fiduciary duties to each other, therefore the discovery rule does not apply.
To the individual claims.
To the,
yep.
Got it.
So you do agree that there is a fiduciary duty that's owed to all five companies, correct?
Yes. Both parties owe the exact same fiduciary duties. So Mr. Watkins' duty wasn't any greater than Mr. Bertucci's duty. Companies, you know, act through their principals. Mr. Bertucci's knowledge, of course, is imputed to the company. And the summary judgment evidence reveals that not only did Mr. Bertucci know exactly what was going on, but even if he didn't, he should have known what was going on. So let me speak to those two points, because they're very important here.
And before you do,
yep.
I want to make sure, Judge, that I didn't kind of, did you get the answer to your question as to how they're related?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Go
ahead. In the timeline, that we have two timelines. The first one, I think it's B, is on the audit, which I'll get back to if I have time. But tab C in our handouts is a timeline I've put together that I call the statute of limitations timeline. I think it has the key dates in there. And this sort of summarizes only some. There's much more evidence in the summary judgment record, but this summarizes some of the summary judgment evidence that reveals that Mr. Bertucci did, in fact, know exactly what was going on. He knew where the money was being spent. He knew that Mr. Watkins was accounting for it as it was being spent. And some of that evidence is highlighted if you look on page 2 of the statute of limitations timeline. Now, that one page really spans a 12-year period from 2002 to 2014. And the evidence that I cite to with the asterisk are all from the executor's own summary judgment evidence, the evidence that the executor put into the summary judgment record. And so that negates any application of the dead man's rule, if that rule even applies at all. Certainly when a party seeking to exclude evidence presents that very evidence, they can't then try to pull it back and exclude it under the rule. And that summary judgment evidence that, again, that I've just summarized, there's much more in the record, It reveals that Mr. Bertucci and Mr. Watkins met regularly, monthly, weekly, sometimes even daily. They discussed the finances. Mr. Bertucci approved the checks. He approved the spending. He was fully informed about where the money was going. And there is nothing in the record to contradict that. That is undisputed summary judgment evidence. Mr. Bertucci also got the cost certifications that they only dealt with the construction costs on the two projects that did go forward. There were a number of other expenses that went out, some on failed projects, some on projects that never got out off the ground. Mr. Bertucci also got the annual audits for the operations of the two projects that did get completed. So he knew where the money was going, and he never complained. And there's no contrary evidence. There's no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Watkins ever concealed anything from Mr. Bertucci, and quite the opposite is true. So we have evidence that he did know, and even if that's not enough, we certainly have evidence that he should have, in the exercise of reasonable diligence, he should have known what was going on. And I'll bring your attention to page 3 of our statute of limitations timeline. The very evidence that the executor says he discovered in 2014, and those were the TCB, that's my client's separate company's account, that was the account that Mr. Bertucci directed my client to use as the account for all of the entities. So
is that evidence that Bertucci instructed him to do that, is that from Bertucci's own evidence, or is that what your client says?
It's the top of page 2. Bertucci's insistent Watkins used the TCB account to deposit Bertucci's capital contributions and to pay out expenses. I've cited
The clerk's record
2468 with an asterisk, so that is from the executor's summary judgment, and also 3101. Honestly, I can't remember what those are off the top of my head, but I believe it's in his summary judgment evidence as well.
Thank you, counsel.
So the evidence that the executor says he fortuitously discovered in 2014, it's the bank records that had been in that storage unit since 2006, and Mr. Bertucci had access to that storage unit. And in fact, the evidence reveals that he had accessed it in the past. He even kept some of his personal items in that storage unit.
Ms. Block?
Yes.
So it seems to be there's a significant dispute between Anthony Bertucci and Watkins as to who controlled BW companies and how they allegedly controlled them. Who is in control of the company? I know this is something in dispute. So what standards should we apply on this question of what constitutes control of an entity or a business?
Well, first of all, let me correct you. I don't think there was any dispute between Mr. Anthony Bertucci, Mr. Watkins about that. There's a dispute between Christopher Bertucci, the executor, and Mr. Watkins about the control.
But either way, what standard should we apply if we're looking at, are there factors we can look at to say, okay, check, this is somebody who's in control of an entity or a business when evaluating that issue?
You have to look at the organizational documents. You have to look at the bylaws. Who is a director? Who is a manager of an LLC? And it's undisputed that they both were directors. They both were officers. Mr. Bertucci was the president of some, if not all, of these companies. Mr. Watkins was vice president. They were both on the board of directors. And a director, an officer, a manager, they all owe fiduciary duties to the organization, and they cannot abdicate their responsibilities simply because someone else has agreed to handle the books. So control is governed by the governing documents. And again, these two sophisticated gentlemen were very careful about setting up corporations and very careful not to ever engage in a partnership between them individually. So that's where you look to see control. So I want to get back to the should have known, because I think this is really critical. We cite to evidence in, you know, I think I'm on page 3 of our statute of limitations timeline. And it's down at the bottom of the page. This is a record cite from Mildred Bertucci's deposition, where she acknowledges that after reviewing the records from the TCB, I think it was the QuickBooks, some QuickBook accounts and some boxes of TCB records that Christopher Bertucci got out of the storage unit that Mr. Bertucci had access to all along. After reviewing those records and, quote, other information we had, close quote, the Bertuccis were able to conclude that Mr. Watkins had allegedly committed the acts that they complain about in their petition. I think that ends the discussion. They acknowledge that once they got the information out of the storage unit that Mr. Bertucci had access to all along and put it together with other information that they already had, they discovered these alleged misappropriations. Mr. Bertucci had that information all along. And again, it's not just access to the storage unit. The evidence reveals that he knew what was going on. He met regularly with Mr. Watkins. These two gentlemen sat across from each other at the table, discussed the finances. And it really is, this sounds simplistic, but it really is as simplistic as math. It's money in, money out. Mr. Bertucci was funding these companies. If he had any question about whether or not the funds that he invested into these companies was being spent appropriately, he could have and had the responsibility as an officer and director of the companies to make inquiry if he didn't think they were being spent appropriately. And if the math ever didn't add up, he could have and should have inquired about it. And in fact, the record shows that there were times when there was a shortfall in the account, in Mr. Watkins' TCB account. And Mr. Watkins had to cover the shortfall, cover the shorts, the deficiencies. And during those, whenever that happened, Mr. Bertucci injected some additional funds. If you ever had any question about why there was a shortfall, he was on notice. He should have and could have inquired about it. But honestly, the truth is that in the 15 years or 14 years that these two gentlemen did business together, Mr. Bertucci never had any reason to suspect any wrongdoing because he knew exactly what was going on. I do want to talk, I've just got a minute or so, I want to talk very briefly about the audit because it is such a big part of the appellant's case. Three things I ask you to keep in mind about the audit. Number one, it is conclusive. Number two, it is admissible. And number three, it is irrelevant. It is irrelevant to the summary judgment issues, to whether or not my client's summary judgment was properly granted. It's conclusive because the executor failed to timely file any exceptions to it. That's very clear under, again, the audit timeline is included in the handout materials as tab B. Failure to timely file exceptions goes to the conclusiveness. Admissibility is a completely separate issue. And this court's opinion in the Vaught versus Lee case and every other case that's discussed it, it's very clear. If it's not verified when it's initially filed by the auditor, it can be verified at any time, even at trial. And in fact, if it's not objected to, it comes in. The executor ignores the fact that the auditor verified his report.
So does the timeline kick once he's verified it, or he's tendered an unverified report that the appellant would think, well, that's nothing. That's like filing my grocery receipt with Judge Herman's court. When does the timeline kick in for them to object?
Cases are very clear. The timeline kicks in when the report is filed. That's what the rule says.
Is it a report if it's not verified?
Yes. It is still a report. And again, the cases say the verification goes to admissibility only. So once it's filed, it's a report. If it's unobjected to timely, it's conclusive. Now, whether or not it comes in at trial, then you have to look at whether or not it's verified. And again, even if it's unverified, it comes in unless it's objected to. It was objected to, so the auditor verified it. And they say in the, I'm out of time, but.
If you would continue to
answer
the question.
I'll just finish up on this one thought.
Yes.
They say in their reply brief that it remains unverified to this day, and that is just not true. I know it's several places in the record, but one is clerk's record at 5544. That's the verification of the October 2018 audit report that the auditor verified. He filed to verify his report, and that was before the summary judgment ruling, before the determination of its admissibility. And I also point out to you that while the auditor attempted to amend his report, it was the executor who objected to that. And the court granted the executor's objection to the amended report, and that's why we're left with the October 2016 report that was verified.
Ms. Black, can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
You had said as to the statute of limitations that there were three ways, exceptions to it. You talked about 1606-9, you talked about the discovery rule. What was the third?
Fraudulent concealment. And so on the discovery rule, we said it doesn't even apply. But then the did know and should have known, those two issues go both to the discovery rule, if it applies, and to fraudulent concealment.
Thank you.
And Mr. Fleckman.
I would like to echo Ms. Block's expression of gratitude to this on-bank consideration. Thank you for this. I've got a lot to unpack here.
Mr. Fleckman, before you unpack your luggage, I asked a question of Ms. Block about what standards should we apply to this question of what constitutes control of an entity or a business. Do you have any standards we should apply for evaluating that issue, since your argument is that Mr. Watkins is in control of the finances of the business?
Mr. Watkins was subject to fiduciary duties by common law, and also subject to fiduciary duties under the corporate statutes, our business organizations code. The partnership, of course, there are two limited liability companies, two corporations, and one limited partnership here. All of the limited liability companies, both of the limited liability companies, have responsibilities, fiduciary responsibilities, to file, to maintain records, to keep records. That's under the business organizations code, because every filing entity must maintain records. Mr. Watkins is the one who elected to do that as his sweat equity for the 40% he got in the venture.
But isn't that duty to the companies, not to necessarily to Bertucci?
I'm sorry, Justice Triano, just
I had COVID last week, so I'm being really, really careful.
Absolutely.
My colleagues are appreciative of me wearing a mask.
Absolutely.
My question is, isn't that duty owed to the companies, not the duty of accounting? Isn't that a duty that's owed to the company?
Interestingly enough, the duty and under the general partnership statute of the business organization code, which is 152, is a duty of loyalty and care owed to the partners and the partnership. That then is extended to limited partnerships under chapter 153. So those responsibilities, both equitable and statutory and common law, govern limited partnerships as well, limited partnership relationships as well. The duties are owed from one partner to another as well as from one partner to the entity. It is true that there are remedies under the derivative action statutes. Let me point out, in connection with the 1606-9 discussion, that Mr. Bertucci had rights and remedies that he asserted in that interpleader action in the district court initially in 2016. Those rights included the Theft Liability Act right that he had, they included his partnership right that he had, and it included his limited partnership rights that he had, I'm sorry, his limited liability company rights that he had. I will simply say this about that entangled issue in the 160069 question. Mr. Bertuzzi comes in as a timely litigant. And by the way, he filed this lawsuit. It wasn't his son who filed this lawsuit. But he comes in as a timely litigant under 160069, even if the discovery rule did not apply, and even if the fraudulent concealment did apply, and both of those did not apply, and both of those do apply. I'll touch on that in a moment. But the 160069 imbroglio here is the following. You've got complete commingling of all of the documents and all of the monies between these five entities. There is, at that point in time, 2016, no way to unscramble the omelet. None. Even Mr. McIntosh, who audited, said he had no way to trace monies to any separate company whatsoever. They had all been commingled in Mr. Watkins' financial account, the TCB account. So then the question is, who has standing at that point to raise it by counterclaim? Well, they are melded entities at that point. They are fused together. Let me address this question about the sale of the property in Nashville, Tennessee. That is absolutely half the issue. The money came back from Nashville from the sale of the properties to the AHP entity. That is true. What Ms. Block has not explained to you is that the monies that went into the development of that project and the purchase of the property are all, much of that was funded through the Texas Community Bank account. So you had essentially commingled funds going into the project. You can't unscramble them when they come back. They belong to all five entities. All of the entities were funded by Bertuzzi at the same, with the same infusions of money. Let me also say, 160069, to answer the question of the panel, 160069 has to be negated by the movement for summary judgment. That's the rule. And the case law is clear on that.
So you just have to raise a fact issue.
Just have to raise a fact issue. Now, I've never seen a 16069 case that involved entities that had been commingled to the point where you couldn't separate their identities. So we did what should have been done. We named them all as potential beneficiaries of the monies in the registry court of the court. Moving from that, there's something that I think is critically important, and I'll reemphasize it, and that is even Ms. Block has said that Mr. Bertuzzi was very content and had no reason to be concerned about his infusions of money into Mr. Watkins' TCB account. We don't disagree with that. He had no reason to know what was going on. What Mr. Watkins says, and I put it in one of the tabs, is that he is the only, I think it's tab 17, he is the only person who had any knowledge of what went into and what went out of that account.
But Mr. Plitman, how do you respond to Ms. Block's contention that Ms. Bertucci indicated that once they saw the records in the unit and couple that with other information that the Bertuccis already had, they concluded about Watkins' actions?
Well, let me point out on that very issue, the lawsuit was filed within 2 years after getting access to that storage unit. Now, it's been presented to you as though the storage unit was easily available, number one. It was locked by Mr. Watkins, and he had not provided the key to Mr. Bertuzzi. Number two, Mr. Bertuzzi was on dialysis at the time. the last thing he was capable of doing was foraging through boxes in a locked storage unit. The third thing is that he had not previously had reason to suspect that his friend was stealing from him. And the documents that we have identified in our briefing show exactly what was going on in terms of the theft. Now, on that issue, let me point something out. We finally got the TCB documents after 4 years, between 2014 and 2018, of trying to get those documents. 4 years there was concealment. Here's the concealment. Number one, Mr. Watkin said, I will not produce those documents. They are my private records. That was false. Number two, we went to court in 2016, halfway through that period. We asked the court, the district court, to grant us a motion to compel. Mr. Watkins put in a false affidavit under oath stating that the only monies in his account, his TCB account, were his side of the, essentially, his side of the fruits of the venture. The only monies in that account were his side. He then said in an email that I have provided, I think, in one of the tabs, he said in an email that there were no mixed funds, no commingled funds in that account. That was false. A year later, after he made, or some years later after he made that statement, I got him on cross-examination in open court, in the probate court, and I finally got him to recant and to admit that $2 million of Mr. Bertuzzi's funds had gone into that account. It was mixed from the very outset.
But Mr. Fleckman, going back in time, you know, before what happened in the probate court, the appellee's brief raises deposition testimony about how Mr. Bertuzzi was hands-on with the business, he had access to TCB's records. So don't these circumstances necessarily require that he keep up with TCB's balance and activities? And to your point, if he gets stonewalled and he's not provided a key and he's not provided these other things, doesn't he have to press his rights, you know, as a partner in the business to get that information and not just let it be?
Justice Kelly, he did press his rights. He hired a law firm, not ours, but he hired a law firm to try to get those documents from 2014 on when he first got notice. That's the discovery
point.
So
2014 is the first time.
That is the first time. And let me go back to those two exhibits. I said I and Jay in their summary judgment exhibits are important. And the reason they're important is because they don't show any of the misappropriations at all. And that was what he was sharing with Mr. Bertuzzi to persuade Mr. Bertuzzi that, as he said in his email, in which I've added in this handout, I have maintained all of the accounting records. I have everything that went through the TCB account, and I am mindful of my fiduciary responsibilities to the family. That's what he said. He, even after the litigation, refused to produce the TCB documents. In the probate court, I had finally to get an order against, I was able to get an order against him when I got him to admit that they were mixed. He had instructed all of his banks not to comply with our subpoenas, so our subpoenas went unanswered. He did everything he could do to conceal those records from Mr. Bertuzzi. Another point I want to make. If you look at the way this thing has, and this is one of our, I've just given it to you as an example, but it is a tab in our handout showing a very, very methodical analysis that we did of his records and how he went about essentially embezzling money. And what it shows in tab 9, we give every benefit of the doubt to him. Every benefit of the doubt. The money that went into his account, basically, as Bertuzzi was providing it, he was taking it out. But he wasn't taking it out simply by cutting checks out of the TCB account to pay his personal bills. He funded it to his Amex account and paid personal bills through the Amex account. He funded it to a Bank of America account that he owned, and he paid his personal bills from there. So someone looking at the TCB account records would not have known. Another point, when we essentially confronted him with a fragment of his QuickBooks record showing the TCB, what had happened in the TCB account, and it indicated it was a QuickBooks record, and that's what Mr. Bertuzzi's son found in that, in happenstance, fortuitously found in that storage unit. That QuickBooks record was 1 year, 2005, and it gave us an idea that there was, in fact, misappropriation. At that point, we confronted, in court, we confronted Mr. Watkins with that record, and his response under oath was that the QuickBooks, which had been maintained for 6 years, were not a realistic representation of any of the financial transactions in my companies, and he said they were merely a hypothetical experiment. Who keeps a hypothetical experiment of detailed QuickBooks records for 6 years? Everything that Mr. Watkins did was an attempt to conceal and withhold from Mr. Bertuzzi. His attorney said before the litigation, I'm not going to turn over any of our bank records without an order requiring us to do so.
Mr. Flatman, you said that all this discovery occurred in 2014, but the business had been going on for years and years, and you do agree that Bertucci owed a fiduciary duty to the entities, correct?
Well, I'm going to qualify that. Mr. Bertucci has a right to rely on his controller, and that's what Mr. Watkins chose to be, was his controller. And Mr. Watkins assured him that he was maintaining the books, and he showed him, and again, if you take a look at the exhibits I and J, here's what they don't disclose. They don't disclose $475,000 that Mr. Watkins is now claiming he was entitled to in compensation. If you look at the handout, Mr. Watkins absolutely contradicts himself in emails to the Bertuzzi family. He says to the Bertuzzi family, for 15 years I have worked without compensation other than the amount that Mr. Bertuzzi had taken, which was $39,000 total over a six-month period. So you have absolute concealment. You have a discovery dispute, discovery issue here. All it takes, they have to negate completely the discovery rule on summary judgment. If there is a fact issue as to discovery, the time of discovery, or what keyed the discovery, then there is no summary judgment on that issue. The same is true on 16069. They have to negate the logical relationship rule under the Wells case was misquoted to you. The logical relationship under the progeny of the Wells case is that if there is a fiduciary relationship, it extends 16069 to multiple transactions, even distinct and disparate transactions, if they're unified by that fiduciary obligation. I've got other things I could say, but I want to be mindful of your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. This case is submitted, and the court will stand in recess. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.